And now I'd like to introduce the head table, so some different faces than you've normally seen. I'm so proud of the folks who are up here. To my immediate left is Alyssa Bish, who is a former student of Kathy Campbell and is our operation and marketing director, and she's the one who makes everything look so seamless and perfect, and we are so thrilled to have her on our team. Thank you, Alyssa. And to my far right is Daniel Duquet. He is a UAA student, and he's a committee member, and he's super involved with a lot of things that have to do with pub trivia and information and ideas for programming, so we're proud to have Daniel as part of our team as well. And then I'd also like to introduce the gentleman to my immediate right, Mr. Ted Galen Carpenter. He is a senior fellow for defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. Dr. Carpenter served as Cato's director of foreign policy studies from 1986 to 1995 and as vice president for defense and foreign policy studies from 1995 to 2011. He's the author of 9 and the editor of 10 books on international affairs, including the most recent one, Perilous Partners, which we have for sale at the front desk, and you'll also see a copy on each table. Those are available for sale for $25, so if you're interested in picking up one of those, you can pay at the front desk. Carpenter is a contributing editor to the National Interest and serves on the editorial boards of Mediterranean Quarterly and the Journal of Strategic Studies, and is the author of more than 400 articles and policy studies. He's a frequent guest on radio and television programs in the United States, Latin America, Europe, East Asia, and other regions. Carpenter received his PhD in U.S. diplomatic history from the University of Texas. Dr. Ted Carpenter is here today to speak to us on friendly dictators. Should America embrace or shun them? Please join me in welcoming him to the podium.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and greetings to the largest state in the union from a resident of the second largest state, Texas. That's a very sore point for a lot of people from Texas that we lost that status in 1959 of being the largest state in the union. I work for the Cato Institute, and I want to say just a few words about that before I discuss the substance of my presentation today. The Cato Institute has been described variously as a libertarian, market liberal, or Jeffersonian liberal think tank. Those terms all mean more or less the same thing. In our bylaws, we emphasize the four primary values of our institute, namely civil liberties, free markets, limited government, and a peaceful foreign policy. My responsibility is in that fourth area, trying to develop a new and more enlightened foreign policy for the United States. Now, Cato has a reputation of being ostentatiously independent, which I assure you in Washington, D.C. is generally not welcomed. Most people in that city line up as members of the red team or blue team, lockstep on every single issue. We don't. We judge positions on each issue about whether those positions support or impede the four values that I mentioned. So we might very well align with the Democrats today on one issue and be working with conservative Republicans the next day on another issue. And that kind of independence, although welcomed in theory, again, tends to be more than a little bit controversial. My topic today is friendly dictators. Should America embrace them or shun them? Now, this focuses on an inherent dilemma for a democratic republic like the United States. After all, we live in a dangerous world, a world in which most governments are not democratic. Ronald Reagan highlighted the ideal for American foreign policy. He said that U.S. foreign policy is, and I quote, based on support of peace, democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. Well, that is the ideal. But the record since the early 20th century indicates that this country has often not lived up to that ideal or even come close to that ideal. Our record points to a far different and less savory conclusion. Now, there may be times when a liberal democracy like the United States, because of its security needs, has to make common cause with unsavory regimes. This is not unique to the United States. For instance, in World War II, Great Britain, a liberal democracy, forged an alliance with the Soviet Union of Joseph Stalin, one of the great mass murderers of the 20th century. In fact, I have a colleague at Cato who said if you looked at the genocide Olympics of the 20th century, believe it or not, Adolf Hitler was only the bronze medalist. Joseph Stalin was the silver medalist, and Mao Zedong was the gold medalist. You're talking tens of millions of people that these leaders murdered. And yet, liberal Britain made common cause with that. Why? Because Britain was facing a dire threat to its security, indeed a threat to its very existence as an independent country. Prime Minister Winston Churchill put it very well, facing up to that dilemma. At one point he said, look, if Adolf Hitler invaded hell, I would have some good words to say about the devil on the floor of the House of Commons. So if a threat is dire enough to a nation's security, you have to compromise your moral values and make common cause with whichever ally might be available to help you with your security. But I would argue that U.S. leaders over the decades have been far too casual about compromising our values to meet far lesser threats. And if you take a look at the roster of authoritarian allies that we've acquired over the decades, that really becomes all too apparent. I'm only going to focus on a few of them. We have 14 chapters in the book that looks at the various alliances. But I'm going to focus on a few of them because I think they illustrate some of the larger problems that we faced. One of the leaders that the United States backed during the Cold War was the leader of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos. Now, Marcos came to power as a young, dynamic, elected leader and soon showed his real stripes, moving to neutralize political opponents, eventually in 1972 declaring martial law and becoming a thoroughgoing dictator, looting his country to the tune of billions of dollars. And yet the United States always praised him as a member of the free world. One wondered what that term meant if someone like Ferdinand Marcos was included in the club. We backed Anastasio Somoza, the second generation dictator of Nicaragua, the heir to the original Somoza dictator. Again, massively corrupt, massively brutal. Someone that, again, we embraced as a good friend of the United States. Joseph Mobutu, the leader of Zaire, Mobutu Sese Seko. Again, a man who came to power, ruled his country for 3 decades, tortured, imprisoned, and murdered political opponents by the thousands, and looted his country to the tune of billions of dollars. We again saw him as a great and noble ally of the United States. A series of South Korean dictators, beginning in the late 1940s with Syngman Rhee, the man who ran South Korea at the time of the Korean War. Later on, backing a man named Park Chung-hee, who ruled that country in the 1960s and 1970s. And this was a time when the United States clearly preferred reliable autocratic clients to unpredictable democracies. The head of the U.S. military command in South Korea put it very well when a third dictator, Chun Doo-hwan, took power in 1980. Now, this is at a time when South Korea has already developed a great deal economically, becoming one of the so-called Asian tigers, a real economic success story. But the commander of U.S. military forces, when Chun launched his coup, said, well, the Koreans are like lemmings. They need a strong leader or they go over the cliff to destruction. Again, we preferred a reliable dictator to an unpredictable democracy. Now, we lucked out with South Korea and the Philippines that when these regimes finally crumbled and democratic regimes took their place, the resentment that we could have expected from the populations of those countries was relatively restrained. It didn't always turn out that way. And one example where it didn't was Iran. We're still paying the price for our policy in that country. The United States, together with Britain, overthrew a democratically elected government in Iran in 1953. Now think about this. This was the first real indigenous democracy in a Muslim country. What that might have led to, a very different path for that civilization, if that system had survived, grown, prospered, and spread. Instead, the United States and Britain, because the democratic leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, dared to nationalize British oil companies, saw him as a great threat to the West. The CIA and British intelligence worked with the Iranian military to overthrow Mossadegh and to put the young Shah of Iran back on the peacock throne as an unconstrained monarch. Well, for a time, that looked like a good strategy. He was a very reliable ally of the United States. But he eventually lost his hold on power. And when he did, the resentment of the Iranian people knew no bounds. They hated the United States. In a few weeks after the Shah was finally removed from power, there was a demonstration in the capital city of Tehran with more than 1 million people chanting in unison, "Death to America." You get the definite feeling that maybe you did something wrong when you have that many people that angry at you. I would like to say we have learned from those experiences, but there is very little evidence that we have. Today, we have American leaders in both the Republican and Democratic Party going out of their way to praise the government of Saudi Arabia as a good friend of the United States. I've argued that with friends like the Saudis, we don't need any enemies because the Saudis have actively worked to undermine American security interests and American values for decades. Is one of the most brutal, corrupt regimes in the world. Indeed, I think with the possible exception of North Korea, it is perhaps the most ugly totalitarian regime on the planet. But this is our good friend. One wonders what may happen if the Saudi people finally get rid of that regime, what they're going to feel about the United States. Having backed that system for more than 70 years. One of our other clients, who was in power from the early 1980s until 2011, was the Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak, who led a thoroughly corrupt Egyptian military regime, one again that looted that unhappy country to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. Utterly corrupt enterprise, Mubarak again imprisoning and torturing political opponents by the droves. Now, one of the things the United States did that I think is one of the more shameful episodes in our history was after the 9/11 attacks, the United States engaged in a policy called rendition. That is, if we apprehended a suspected terrorist, we had a little problem like the Constitution of the United States and assorted laws here that prevented us, at least in theory, from torturing these people. So what American officials did was essentially to outsource torture. We would turn suspects over to friendly governments, which included the Egyptian dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak, and oddly enough, given what has happened recently, the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. Now, we knew what these governments did to prisoners. There certainly was no secret here. And yet, we seem to think that that absolved our leaders of responsibility for the conduct that occurred. Mubarak was finally overthrown in 2011 in the so-called Arab Spring. But the attitude of the United States is very interesting. The Vice President, Joe Biden, was interviewed on PBS at the time the demonstrations were really arising against Mubarak. And he was asked, look, Mubarak's a dictator. Should we gently suggest that he step aside? And Biden took great affront at that. He said, no, Hosni Mubarak is not a dictator. Well, really, rigged elections, imprisoning political opponents, torturing political opponents, that doesn't make someone a dictator. Well, the U.S. continued that policy when, briefly, Egyptian democracy took hold. And one of the things we found out is that Mubarak had badly weakened secular opponents of his regime. Guess who was in the wings to take power then? The religious opponents of his regime. Because it's very simple. You know, if you are a government security agent, if you want to raid an opposition meeting at a cafe, very easy to do that. You bust in, you arrest people, throw them in prison. If a meeting is being held in a mosque, it's a little bit tougher to do. And so the religious opponents survived a lot better than did the secular opponents of the regime. Same thing had happened in Iran, by the way, with the Shah. That's why the Ayatollah Khomeini and his people were in such a strong position to take power when the Shah finally fell from power, because the Shah had so badly weakened secular opponents. An election is held in Egypt, and guess what? The Muslim Brotherhood is the dominant force. The leader of that faction, Mohamed Morsi, becomes the new president. He lasts all of 13 months, and the Egyptian military, seeing his own interests in jeopardy, overthrow him. With the head of that junta, a general by the name of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Now, the United States refuses to call this a coup. Again, I'm not sure what you do call it when the military overthrows a democratically elected government. I think that's a coup. But we wouldn't call it that because that would have required us to cut off all aid to the Egyptian government. And we were very quick to cozy up to the new Egyptian leader. Now, the Egyptian military proceeds to hold a new election. And el-Sisi wins 96% of the vote. Now, there's a time when the United States used to ridicule phony elections like that. Political opponents were banned from running for office. There was no free press in Egypt. There was a cult of personality that had developed around el-Sisi that a colleague of mine who was in Egypt at the time and who'd been to North Korea said it really reminded him of North Korea, because everywhere you looked, there were posters of el-Sisi, gigantic posters everywhere. And the press was just fawning all over him. Well, amazingly enough, he wins a decisive victory. And the U.S. rushes back to provide generous aid, including military aid, to his new regime. So this sounds awfully familiar. very, very similar to what we have been doing the past 60 years, and angering a lot of populations in the process. Now, as I said, there may be times when it's necessary to make an alliance with an authoritarian regime. But we need some standards as to when that is necessary, when it is gratuitous, when we're just needlessly compromising our values, and when it's a close call. And we develop a number of standards in this book. The first consideration that we look at is, what is the nature and extent of the interests of this country at stake? And interests can be economic and they can be strategic. There are also different levels, vital interests, something that is absolutely central to the independence and liberty of this country. We've had a nasty habit, though, over the decades of lumping everything into that category. But if you break it down, there are other categories. Secondary interests, things that are important to us, that are certainly desirable, but are not absolutely essential to our survival as a nation, to our independence, to our liberty. A secondary interest, for example, I would argue is, let's say, preventing China from becoming the undisputed dominant power in East Asia. Given our strategic and economic stakes in that region, we'd prefer a situation where China was not that dominant. It's not vital. We can certainly survive such a situation, but we'd prefer something other than that. Down from that category, peripheral interests. Things that are more annoyances to the United States than are absolutely essential. The radical left-wing government in Venezuela, a mid-sized country in our own hemisphere, an oil producer. We don't like having a left-wing dictatorship there, but again, that does not really pose a direct serious threat to us. And then a category that I would describe as non-interests, irrelevant matters. Whether East Timor is well governed or whether Bosnia stays intact or divides into a Muslim entity and a Serb entity can be and should be a matter of complete indifference to the United States. We don't have a dog in that fight. A second consideration is, how severe is the threat to whatever interest is at stake? Again, we tend to see massive threats everywhere. I am so tired of the Hitler analogy. Every time there is a rise of an unpleasant dictator somewhere in the world challenging the United States, it is the next Hitler. Ho Chi Minh in North Vietnam was the next Hitler. Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia was the next Hitler. Saddam Hussein, of course, was the next Hitler. And Bashar al-Assad in Syria apparently is now the next Hitler when Vladimir Putin isn't. Well, one of the great things about world affairs is that, fortunately, Hitlers are relatively rare. Really monstrous leaders who get control of major countries. Most of the unpleasant leaders we have to deal with tend to run relatively weak countries. And that is something we always ought to keep in mind. Not every threat is the equivalent of another Nazi Germany. And then the third consideration is, how bad is the prospective ally that we're considering? There's a difference between a garden variety corrupt autocrat and a psychopathic mass murderer. We need to make that distinction. We also owe it to the American people to be honest about the nature of our allies. And again, throughout the Cold War, and we've seen it more recently with the so-called War on Terror, we tend to gloss over the record of these people. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what we shouldn't be doing. Interestingly enough, it's a bipartisan folly as well of portraying these people as something they're not. Like portraying the Saudis as friends of the United States. And at the same time looking at ISIS and saying, my God, these people are the most brutal, horrible individuals in the world. Look at that, they behead people. I mean, how barbaric is that? Conveniently ignoring the fact that last year our Saudi-friendly allied government beheaded 83 people. How many news stories did you see about that? Very few, I'll guarantee you. The first quote is from a man who actually insisted that moral principles ought to be a central feature of American foreign policy, President Jimmy Carter. Now, Carter was in Iran, New Year's Eve, 1977. And that's an important date because it's about 14 months before the Shah loses power. Now, Carter has a toast to the Shah of Iran. And this is the quote. Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled regions of the world. Talk about misreading the situation. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to your leadership and to the respect and admiration and love which your people give to you. Now, apparently, concluding that our association with the Shah for the last quarter century hadn't tied the United States closely enough to his fortunes, he emphasized that we had no other nation on earth which is closer to us in planning for our mutual security, but it wasn't just a security alliance, in Carter's view. The cause of human rights is one that is also shared deeply by our people and by the leaders of our two nations. Now, this occurs after human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others, had documented the systematic imprisonment and torture conducted by the Shah's security forces. It is one of the worst human rights records in the world. Carter certainly knew that. Why then go out of your way to heap praise on this ruler? But again, this wasn't just Jimmy Carter. A few years later, Vice President George H.W. Bush was in the Philippines. And he lavished praise on the Philippines dictator, Ferdinand Marcos. We stand with you, sir, Bush said. We love your adherence to democratic principle and to the democratic processes. This to the man who had overthrown the Philippines' democracy, imposed martial law, and then proceeded to loot that country. The U.S. was providing billions in aid to the Philippines, something that apparently benefited primarily the international shoe industry because Imelda Marcos, Ferdinand's wife, was notorious for buying thousands and thousands of shoes. Again, why gloss over the real record, even if you have to have a pragmatic partnership with an authoritarian regime? You don't have to go out of your way to make those kinds of statements. And again, in the Philippines and in South Korea and some other places, we lucked out in that the population seemed to forgive our officials for that track record. In Iran, and to a lesser but significant extent in Nicaragua, they did not forgive us to that extent. What my co-author and I have outlined in this book is a policy of ethical pragmatism. We recognize there are occasions when one may have to make moral compromises to protect the essential security of the United States. But that needs to be the exception, not the rule. And we need to apply those standards that I've outlined to minimize the number of occasions when we will compromise our moral values that way. I will leave it at that, and I'll be very happy to take your questions and comments. Thank you very much.
If you could please wait for the microphone, we are recording this for the radio. I want to thank our speaker for giving us a little trip around the world. And I look forward to the questions on behalf of the board of director. They would like to present you with this gift and hope that you will come back again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If you could just wait for the microphone.
Thank you, sir. A very original address. But isn't the main thrust of your argument that the United States has a tendency to screw up every time it intervenes in the internal affairs of another country? You're reminding me a little bit of, particularly in your citations, to sort of the soft, wishy-washy, pro-democratic perspective of both Reagan and Carter, that of John Foster Dulles's famous quip, that who was one of the great and lasting Secretaries of State of the United States, who snapped that the United States has no friends, it only has interests. And I wondered if you would apply these two different philosophies to what I see as the current administration's error in going after the Syrian president and creating an enemy where our enemy's enemy should be our friend, and giving an opportunity for Russia to come in and do exactly what the United States normally does.
It's a very good set of questions. The first part of that, I think our officials have had a tendency to underestimate the complexity of other societies. We think we understand a situation, barge in, and then often make an already bad situation even worse. Iraq was a classic example of that. Believe it or not, George W. Bush, about a year after the invasion, admitted he had never realized that Islam was divided into Sunni and Shiite factions. Well, that isn't too bad if the president doesn't know that, as long as the president's advisors really understand the situation. Unfortunately, he had surrounded himself with interventionist ideologues who knew about as much about Iraq as he did. And you can see where that kind of policy led. I'm glad you mentioned Syria, because this is one of those situations that is hellishly complex. And yet, people in the political and foreign policy debates in this country blithely ignore that complexity. I don't know how many times members of the Obama administration and the Republican opponents, conservative activists, liberal activists, have said, look, we have to go after ISIS and crush ISIS. Okay. And in the next breath, they will talk about getting rid of Bashar al-Assad and limiting Iran's influence. And you want to go time out, given the dynamics in Syria, who the hell do you think are the primary opponents of ISIS on the ground in Syria? It is Bashar al-Assad and his coalition of religious minorities against the Sunni-dominated ISIS faction. It is Iran and its Shiite allies in Iraq and Hezbollah in Lebanon, again, versus hardline Sunni factions. In Syria, if you go after ISIS, you automatically strengthen Assad's position. If you go after Assad, you will automatically strengthen the position of ISIS. Now, I know there is the search for the moderate Syrian alternative. We have spent $41 million in a training program to try to train and arm moderate Syrian insurgents. We managed to train a few dozen, of which, according to the latest report, four or five are still in the field fighting. Now, even by Washington, D.C. standards, that is not very cost effective. The brutal reality is Syria is a bipolar, factionalized society. I don't want to say there aren't Syrian moderates, but they're few in number and they're highly factionalized. Moderate, secular Syrians are not a serious force at this point. And so you have to face that dilemma. In essence, unless you're willing to withdraw and just let the parties fight it out, which is an option, but if you're determined to back one side or the other, you have to choose your poison. You can't pretend that you can defeat both Assad and the Shiite faction in one hand and ISIS in the other. That's not a coherent policy. And yet, both sides of the political spectrum try to avoid that, making that choice. They don't want to face that fact.
Okay. Doctor, a perfect lead into the next question. If you had to choose between democracy, the rule of law, or stability in the region, if the U.S. has to pick one of those, which one do you feel is more important? And then, if you can, just to talk a little bit about the Arab Spring, what you're feeling on the actual impetus behind that.
Okay. Look, I would argue that as far as our interests are concerned, we have the luxury, being a superpower, of standing back and gently trying to influence outcomes with, I think, the rule of law being the primary value. Democracy can mean one vote, one person, one vote, one time, and that doesn't turn out very well. And stability, yeah, we've opted for that for the past 6 or 7 decades, that being the paramount value. That hasn't worked out particularly well. So I think encouraging the rule of law, but being that beacon, that inspiration, not trying to impose those values at the point of American bayonets or cruise missiles. That doesn't work very well as a tactic. The Arab Spring, I think, in some ways, was simply the first stage of a lot of change that is taking place throughout much of the Muslim world. We don't know how that's going to turn out. To a very large extent, I think what we're seeing, particularly in the Middle East, Persian Gulf region, and North Africa as well, is an Islamic version of the religious wars that divided Christianity, that tormented Christianity during the 1500s. And it's difficult to impossible for an outside power to influence that in a decisive, much less beneficial way. And again, if that's the case, if there is a Sunni-Shiite regional proxy war taking place, and there's a lot of evidence that that is what is happening in country after country, Syria, Bahrain, Yemen, Iraq, other places, what do we have to offer there? What can we determine as an outside power without just building resentment on all sides when we interfere? So I think, again, standing back, offering the American system as an example, and it'd be nice if we had a somewhat more appealing and effective example than what we've had recently. The current quadrennial clown show that passes for our political process is not all that inspiring. So I think at least don't try to be not just the global policeman, which is what we have done. We have tried to be the global armed social worker, and that really has not worked.
Does the Cato Institute or you have a view on the wisdom of the recent nuclear agreement with Persia, with Iran?
The Institute, by law, cannot take an official position on the agreement or any other political question. My personal view is that the Iran agreement is the least bad of the available outcomes, because the primary alternatives to that agreement would be either one, no constraint on Iran's nuclear program, that increases the temptation for Tehran to proceed to weaponize its program. I don't think Iranian leaders have actually made that decision yet, but that would increase the incentive for them to do it. The other option is a war for regime change to prevent Iran from ever acquiring a nuclear arsenal. The argument that I've heard so often, well, we need a better agreement, I think is either delusional or insincere. Because when you take a look at the terms that the Hawks demand, unconditional inspections of all suspected sites on demand, and then a partial, very slow lifting of sanctions if the Iranian government would agree to this unlimited inspections regime, no Iranian government would ever sign such an agreement. No government of any mid-sized power, absent a decisive defeat in war, would ever sign such an agreement. I think Thomas Jefferson could show up in Tehran tomorrow at the head of a new democratic, pro-Western government in Iran, and even he would not sign the kind of agreement that the Hawks are demanding. So that's not a realistic alternative. The other options are no restraint, probable nuclear proliferation, or war, and a war that would make the Iraq war look like a stroll in the park.
Could you comment on your view on, or Cato's view on, how effective the United Nations is and how much the United States should rely on it to affect its policies in support of rule of law and democracy and so forth?
Yeah, I've long argued that the United Nations is a marginal actor in world affairs, and it is going to remain so. To a large extent, the UN is a dumping ground for issues that the great powers do not want to address directly. And given the nature of the international system, I don't see that changing anytime soon. You're not going to get the major powers to relinquish portions of their sovereignty that would be required for the UN to become a truly effective, independent actor in international affairs. So it's useful in some respects. We've seen how the UN has been able to manage transitions from wars to post-war settings. We saw it in Afghanistan, which wasn't particularly effective, in Namibia, in a variety of other places. So the UN has its uses, but it's a modest mission.
Hello. My name is Catherine Taylor. I'm a student of political science at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. I took my first class at the age of 25 at the university, my first intro to political science, and we read The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And after serving 5 years in the Navy and feeling like I knew a lot about my country, I felt really let down. and I felt like I had been lied to almost, because I had, like you were talking about with Hitler, always heard Hitler was the worst person on earth, and then we learned about Mao and everybody else. And I'm wondering what your opinion on the educational system and the politics around that, how that affects, like you said, George Bush not doing the difference between Shia and Sunni.
Well, first of all, the educational system in the United States varies tremendously in quality from place to place. So I don't want to generalize that. I think some people get a very good education. They get, in particular, a very good knowledge, good background in world affairs. Others scarcely learn that there's anything outside the borders of the United States, and a lot in between those two extremes. So I think it's very difficult to generalize. I would like to see, overall, knowledge of world affairs increased in the United States. I would like to think that, some years, maybe 20 years from now, that if there is a presidential debate like we have seen this year, that the degree of sophistication regarding foreign policy would be somewhat greater than what we have seen so far. And I'm being my diplomatic best with that.
Thank you again for your presentation. Prescinding for the moment from the Middle East and Russia, which is difficult to do, the United States faces three major global issues in the near future. One is climate change and the impact of that and what the United States response should be. A second is the contest for water, for consumable water, which is going to raise serious policy issues. And the third is the coming contest for sovereignty over the economic resources of the Arctic. Does the Cato Institute have those on its agenda, and how do you think the United States should apply your principles as we face those issues?
All right. The answer, the first part, is yes, Cato is looking at those issues. You've managed to identify three issues that are generally outside my areas of expertise, so I'm not going to comment in depth on any of them. I do have colleagues who look at those issues and know 50 times more than I do. I'm a little more sophisticated about all of those issues than George Bush was about Iraq, but only modestly so. I will say that the Arctic one in some ways is the most interesting because it is yet another arena of a developing conflict between the United States and Russia, as if we needed another arena. This is another foreign policy I think the United States has badly mishandled, almost from the very beginning with the collapse of the Soviet Union. One of the first actions of the United States and its allies was to expand NATO into Russia's traditional sphere of influence. The second step was to trample on Russian longstanding interests in the Balkans, intervening against Serbia. And then we follow that up with a second stage of NATO expansion, taking in the Baltic republics that had been components of the Soviet Union itself, and pushing toward membership in NATO for Ukraine and Georgia. What we saw in 2008 with the Georgian War was Russia really beginning to push back. And the Western actions toward Russia in the decade and a half after the end of the Cold War, I thought was reminiscent of the victorious Allied treatment of Weimar Germany during the 1920s and early 1930s. Now, it hasn't turned out as badly yet as that episode did, but Western actions, I think, went a long way to empower a nationalist like Vladimir Putin. And if you think Putin is bad, there are people in the wings in Russia that make Putin look like an enlightened Western-style Democrat. This could get a lot worse. If Georgia was Russia's first pushback against the West, seizing Crimea was the second and more emphatic notice to the West. Do not even think about trying to incorporate Ukraine into NATO. That is crossing one of our red lines. We're not going to put up with it. The United States, I think, has to recognize there are still spheres of influence in the world. That is very much in Russia's sphere of influence, and we need to tread carefully. And as I said, the Arctic is another region where our interests could really collide. That would be unfortunate in the extreme. Our actions also, unfortunately, are driving Russia and China together. Now, this violates one of Henry Kissinger's wisest statements, where he said, it should always be the policy of the United States to be closer in our relations to both Beijing and Moscow than they are to each other. Instead, we're pushing them together. Russia is now China's largest energy supplier. Russian and Chinese forces are conducting joint military exercises, something they haven't done since the 1950s. You know, again, our clumsy foreign policy is making a difficult situation even worse.
Thank you for coming. I have two questions. One is like based on education, and like throughout elementary school, we were taught that, the West and the expansion of the West, like we were told it was like a peaceful peaceful expansion, and when in reality, as my education grew, as I grew up until like 25, 23, I now just learned like the atrocities of slavery and the Civil War, and also like the genocide that, you know, the American government has done. And with education, we were ingrained that America is like, oh, we were founded on peaceful, loving, liberal institutions. And also, my second question is the role of the media, because I'm sure when you mentioned that Jimmy Carter expressed his love for whoever he was, I'm sure there was like a media, like televising that news like directly to the American people. I'd like to find out how the media really affects American perception, and how can we filter out like propaganda as opposed to reality.
Okay, the first point, I will say one thing about the American educational system, and particularly how it has developed more recently. At least we are looking at the warts in America's historical record. Most countries don't look at their own conduct in a critical way. We're at least willing to do that. And I think that is worthwhile. Keep in mind, Carter's statement came before the 24-hour news cycle and news channels like CNN and Fox News. So American people saw an excerpt of that speech. They did not get the thing live. And that has changed a lot. We do have that 24-hour news cycle now. And we cover a lot of things, not necessarily well, but people get a lot of superficial information. And that doesn't necessarily translate into more in-depth analysis of what is going on. So, you know, to take Syria, you see lots and lots of footage of bombed out neighborhoods, of suffering populations, of refugees fleeing the country, and so on. But how many stories have you seen about the divisions in that society, the Sunni-Shiite divisions, the other dynamics that are driving that conflict, that are, it's not just a case of a brutal dictatorship versus people thirsting for freedom. That's a grotesque oversimplification of the situation there. And yet, if you take a look at most of the television footage and much of the newspaper articles, that's kind of the image you get. So a very superficial impression, even though technically you're getting a lot of coverage.
You mentioned the Iran deal and how you suggested we take action, but by taking any action, how would that affect both our relations with the Middle East and the Middle East's reaction within themselves?
Well, it's interesting because with the exception of Israel, even countries like Saudi Arabia and so on have reluctantly signed on to the Iran agreement, that this is the best available option. I think that's probably a correct reading. And we also have to examine what would happen if we repudiate that agreement. You know, keep in mind, and again, a lot of our news coverage acts as though this is an agreement between the United States and Iran. It is not. It is an agreement between the so-called P5-1 powers, the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, and Iran. Well, if we back out of the agreement, Russia and China have made it very, very clear they're not backing a resumption of sanctions. I will guarantee you India will not go along with it. I think there's a serious question of whether France and Germany would go along with resuming sanctions. Our favorite lapdog, Great Britain, will, probably. But, you know, again, that does not suggest an effective sanctions regime. If you have that many major economic and strategic players that aren't going to go along with a resumption of a hardline policy, that policy has no chance of working whatsoever. And I think most of the Middle East powers, again, with the exception of Israel, understand that point. Do we have time for one more question? Two more questions, all right.
I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more on your views towards Putin. That's number one. And number two, could you talk a little bit about Tibet?
About Tibet, okay. with regard to Putin, I described him as in the tradition of the so-called reform czars, an autocrat, but a modernist, someone who is doing a delicate political balancing act domestically, certainly has authoritarian tendencies, but Russian policy under Putin, to me, has been more defensive than offensive. What Putin did was to draw a line and say the Western encroachment on Russia's sphere of influence had come to an end, that Moscow was not going to put up with any more Western penetration of the Russian sphere of influence. Russia is not a rising power, however. Those who see Putin as, again, the next Hitler, ignore Russia's tremendous problems, an aging population. It's one of the only countries, I think, in the industrialized world where life expectancy is going down, not up. It is an unbalanced economy, heavily, heavily, heavily dependent upon high commodity prices, particularly for oil. Well, the crash of the world oil price market has badly weakened Russia's position. So I think if we do not go out of our way to trample on core Russian interests, there is little reason for a conflict with Russia. We don't really have interests that conflict that much as long as we, the United States, are willing to exercise some restraint. And the Russians have actually pulled our chestnuts out of the fire a couple of times in Syria. First of all, when the United States was foolishly thinking about launching airstrikes against Assad because of the chemical weapons episode, and Russia negotiated a diplomatic solution to that problem. And more recently now with Russia intervening on behalf of Assad to fight ISIS. And the U.S. response was hostile initially, and now we are talking to Moscow, apparently realizing, gee, you know, if the Russians are fighting ISIS and we want to destroy ISIS, then what the Russians are doing that's not necessarily a bad thing from our standpoint. So I think there's hope for U.S.-Russian relations if the United States is a little more perceptive and a little more flexible than it has been. With regard to Tibet, that's one of those core issues. The Chinese are not going to back down, not now, not ever. They regard that as a settled issue. If we bring it up, all that does is create an irritant in U.S.-China relations. The Chinese policy, certainly in Tibet, has not been gentle. It has not been enlightened. There is no sign that it's going to get much better. But, you know, that's one of those really core emotional issues for the Chinese. I've talked to them on many occasions on this. They're even more adamant, I think, about Tibet than they are about Taiwan. And Taiwan is one of those nasty potential flashpoints between China and the U.S.
So what are some benefits with the existence of dictators, and which dictators do you personally admire the most and why?
It's interesting because Publishers Weekly took some issue with the title of the book and said there didn't seem to be too many benefits listed in the book about associations with dictators. There were a lot of pitfalls, not many benefits. I think in occasional situations where we've had more limited partnerships with authoritarian regimes, we've done reasonably well. For instance, during the Cold War, the U.S. had a pragmatic relationship with the dictator of Yugoslavia, Marshal Tito. And that caused some real problems for the Soviet goal of dominating Europe, because it kind of knocked a hole in the Soviet phalanx that was moving west from Eastern Europe. And it gave the Russians something to worry about if they decided to commit acts of aggression. I think Nixon's opening to China was an extremely beneficial move, normalizing relations with that country, but even more than that, developing a de facto strategic partnership that again gave the Soviet Union something to worry about. It complicated Moscow's strategic calculations. But in both of those cases, our leaders were much more realistic than they were with many of the other partnerships. We recognize that, look, we're dealing with really unsavory, brutal dictatorships. We're not going to gloss over that. We're not going to pretend that these regimes are something they're not. This is a pragmatic partnership, nothing more than that. And I think that works out reasonably well from time to time. But even that needs to be the exception more than the rule.
I'd like to thank Dr. Carpenter for coming to speak to us again today, and a shout out to Kathy Campbell and all the wonderful students from Eagle River High School. Hope to see you all again. We're going to be back here on the 2nd of October, and our next World Matters series is on the 8th, so keep us on your radar. Thank you. And if you'd like to recycle your name tags, that's at the front.